The Bane Free Radio Hour.
Hi there, I'm Griffin Barber, your host for today's edition of the Bane Free Radio Hour. Most famous, perhaps, for his Star Wars novels featuring Admiral Thrawn, Timothy Zahn has also written award-winning stories, including a Hugo-winning novella, Cascade Point. Mr. Zahn has also recently collaborated with David Weber on the Manticore Ascendant series set in Weber's immensely popular Honorverse. He's created his own universes as well, including a number of standalone works, trilogies, and the fantastic Dragonback series. A fellow Illinoisan, Timothy is here today to talk about The Icarus Job, sequel to The Icarus Twin, part of the Icarus Saga, a series I hope to see a lot more of in the future. Hello and welcome, Timothy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, hardest questions first. What is the coolest aspect of The Icarus Job for you as the writer?
With all of this kind of puzzle box story, the fun part is finding all the pieces, fitting them together, and laying them out in a way that the reader can figure out, though hopefully not too quickly, and that Rourke and Celine can figure out. Make everything fit with not just internally to this book, but also with the previous books.
So, and as a fan of SF, is that the same thing, or is it something slightly different?
What do you mean the same thing?
The coolest aspect as a fan of SF of your...
Yeah, I mean it comes under the heading of world building, getting all of the technology and the society and the characters to fit together in a reasonable and believable fashion. But yeah, that's what I like in general science fiction as well.
Okay, so it's safe to say you didn't stumble on that aspect, but you worked your way towards it with that in mind, right?
About 40 years worth of writing has worked me toward that direction.
Yeah, yes. I imagine so. So The Icarus Job is the sequel to the series begun in 1999. Right. Did you always plan to get back to this universe, or did something prompt you to resume working on the universe lately?
Well, I always wanted to go back to the universe I created in The Icarus Hunt. The problem was that for 20 years, I couldn't come up with a storyline for those characters. Mulled at it periodically. Then 2020 and COVID hit, and suddenly there were no conventions to fill up my weekends. So, okay, I can do another book this year. Came up with an idea, pitched it to my agent, and he said that a sequel to a 20-year-old book, unless that book was hugely successful, just isn't going to fly. So he suggested I do what one of his other clients had done, take the same universe, but pick new protagonists to fit into it. So I came up with Rourke and Celine, figured out a way to a storyline for it and a way to bring all the old characters back in as supporting players, made sure that everything that the reader needed would be folded into this book so they didn't have to have read the Icarus Hunt first. In fact, my agent told me after he accepted it for to pass around that he'd given it to one of his beta readers without telling her that it was a sequel, and she never knew.
Very cool.
So, yeah, so that in that case, it worked. It was successful. Tony bought it at Bane. It won a Dragon Award, by the way, so if we're adding awards, not that we are. But, yeah, Icarus Plot won a Dragon Award.
That's great. And you've subsequently come up with, this is the third follow-up?
We've got three books coming up, Icarus, let's see, Changeling, Needle, and Coda.
Oh. So after still more technical difficulties that I believe Tim has some theories on where they might come from, we are back and attempting to finish out this interview.
Yeah, well, I've established in the Icarus Saga that the Path have backdoors into a lot of electronic communications and data gathering things and security systems. So it's possible Subdirector Nask just doesn't want me talking about them right now. So we'll see if we can get around him.
Absolutely. All right. So we asked a little bit about the references to his father's sayings. Did you have a relative full of such pithy sayings, or were these references simply a cool mechanism to illustrate Gregory's character and make a little light of the dire situations he and his partner find themselves in?
They're cool. I like putting them in. They're actually, there was no relative, but these are somewhat of a throwback to the old Banachek TV series, which were a bunch of mystery puzzle box sort of things. So George Papard is the lead character. Right. It was always there's an old Polish saying that says, and he'd make something up.
Right.
So this is kind of a throwback to that. Our son is doing the copy editing, actually more like line editing on these books. And he said after about the first or second book, he was really looking forward to meeting Gregory's father. So I hadn't planned to do it, but he shows up in the last two books. Yes, they're going to get to meet Gregory's father.
Cool.
I've also thought on occasion of printing a bunch of these up on little slips of paper and putting them into a jar called a tip jar on my table at conventions. Don't put money in, take one of these out. Because right. These are wise sayings that Gregory's father has come up with.
They may have less use for people that are not involved in international or interstellar hijinks. But I'm sure they could be applied to some circumstances otherwise. So which character in the Icarus job surprised you?
Nobody really surprised me. I mean, there are characters I realize, okay, I can take this character further on in the series. But, you know, you hear a lot of writers saying, well, the character took over the story. My characters are much better behaved. I'm the director. They are the actors. They do what I tell them to. Which doesn't mean I can't take suggestions from them. But generally, I know where all the character arcs are going to end up, know where all the plot threads are going to end up. So nobody really surprises me.
But nobody takes on a bigger role than you expected at the outset?
More like, okay, I know what this character's role. Hugin is a good example, one of the expediters for Subdirector Nask. He showed up in Icarus' job. And I realize he can be useful down the line. So he continues on through the rest of the series. By the way, Hugin and Munin are in my
the ravens, my, Odin's ravens, right?
Odin's ravens, but their physical descriptions in my mind are those of the two bodyguards for Doyle Lonnegan in The Sting. The little short one played by Charles Bierkopf and the big tall one.
That's one of my favorite movies too. I love that movie. The music soundtrack is amazing.
Yep, and Doyle Lonnegan's really a good boss. He can his subordinates are not afraid to argue points with him. He will take suggestions from them. As movie villains, he's really goes pretty well. So he's not exactly the model for Nask, but I can see some elements in there of Nask. Okay, I don't like Rourke. I don't necessarily trust him. But there are places where we are on the same path and we can be useful to each other.
Yep. And that's proven out in the Icarus job too. It's they're on a parallel path in some cases, and that so long as each of them stays in their lane, they'll be okay.
And Rourke has the advantage. Rourke and Selene have the advantage. They're not really official. It's think of it as the Cold War, for example. Though it's not military, it's the economic power that the Path have.
Right.
But you have trouble dealing with officials from either side. Gregory and Selene are in the middle. They are just normal civilians, citizens. They can play both sides and find the common ground, whereas really nobody else could fit that position. And Nask recognizes that's useful. Probably the admiral recognizes it's useful too, though he probably would admit it to his bosses.
And they themselves recognize it, like nobody else can do this. So we have value as that independent kind of third party kind of deal.
Yes.
So in a similar vein, which character from the Icarus job would you want to avoid, like the plague, and why?
Cherno, obviously the criminal boss. Nikki is an interesting character, but as an assassin, she is kind of a loner. If you can get her on your side, that's a good thing, but your path and hers are not going to parallel for very long.
Right.
That character, by the way, is named for a fan who bought her way into the book at a charity auction, LibertyCon last year.
Neat. Got a red shirt on her, huh? Or better than a red shirt. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I occasionally do the charity auction character in the book. Actually, the last book, Icarus Coda, another guy bought his way in for that one. So we've got two Tuckerizations going on here, and some money was raised for charity, which works out very well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've participated in that too. I put someone in and as a red shirt, though. They just basically got in to get killed.
If you really want to milk the thing, I found out, you auction off a role in a book, then you auction off the decision on whether that character lives or dies.
There you go.
I did that stupidly once, because then I had to not only pay to have my wife in one of Weber's Honorverse books, I had to pay again to keep her alive. So one of the two worst ideas I've ever given to David Weber.
More costly, anyway.
More costly, yes.
Yeah. So which character would you want as an ally?
Obviously, Rourke and Selene would be good allies. Hugin and Nask, if you can find the common ground. They both, Nask has a lot of power behind him as a subdirector of the path. So he would be a good ally. Again, the tricky part is making sure you are actually on common ground, because he would not hesitate to throw you to the wolves if that was what served the path best.
So the Icarus job is more than a few noir elements. Is this a favorite genre of yours at all?
It seems to have developed that way after the Quadrail series. There's a noir aspect. Our son pointed out that a lot of my series tend to go with odd means of transportation, the Quadrails with the tunnels and the trains at light year per minute. Obviously, the Icarus saga with the portals. Various things like that. I hadn't really focused on that, but it seems to have become something of a standard for me.
Right. I just, in this particular instance, it was the crime boss, the government, the other government.
Yeah.
the dame, who's obviously not what she seems to be. All those kind of things were kind of neat tropes that I saw worked in there. That I guess they're pretty much not just bound by noir, but the fact that the characters are kind of ground down in the middle of this all these gears is something that struck me as very noir.
Yeah, there are no characters named Philip Marlowe, but you know, maybe someday.
Yeah, maybe Marlowe Phil.
Yeah.
Sounds like a Star Wars name.
Or I could do the Marlowe Philharmonic or something like that, hide it a little bit better.
There we go. So I'm always interested in what authors read. So what's on your to-be-read pile right now?
Well, I just finished reading a book about... it was done as interviews and reports from the people themselves, OSS and SOE... agents behind enemy lines in World War II. That was very interesting. Just finished that last night, so tonight I'll be looking at my read shelf and figure out what I'm going to do. We're going on a longer trip later this year, and I've already picked out which books I'm going to download onto my Kindle, because I don't want to take heavy paper when I'm traveling. One of those, definitely at the top of the list, will be some of the Jeeves and Wooster stories of P.G. Wodehouse. Okay. So those should be fun. I enjoyed the series, the BBC, I think it was BBC did, maybe it was PBS, who knows, but with Hugh Laurie and lost his name. But I've enjoyed those stories. I'm looking forward to reading the originals. And I think one of the other books I'm going to throw in for when I get tired of being amused, History of the Roman Empire. I haven't studied that very much, and that sounds like it would be interesting.
Yeah, there's an excellent series of books that they chronicle the individual legions. And their historical references. It's Dando Collins with a hyphen in between Dando and Collins.
Okay.
They're amazing books. They get a little bit repetitive, but he did like nine or 10 of them because they're each of the individual, like from their raising to their demise. It's pretty interesting stuff.
I'll start with an overview, but that sounds like it'd be interesting to go into after that.
So the Icarus job has bounty hunters, assassins, aliens, Crockets, a term I love, by the way, and poorly understood technology. Is there something about these tropes of SF that attracted you to the genre in the first place?
I like the puzzle box, mystery, politics, action sort of mix. And that setting lends itself very well to that. Plus the fact, if we got poorly understood technology, I get to explore finding new bits and pieces of it as I go along in the series.
Right. And so the Crockett's, that term, that where did that originate?
Oh, Davy Crockett, of course. King of the Wild Frontier. I grew up with Fess Parker on Disney back in the 50s.
Right. Great stuff. So there's a lot going on between the competing interests in the Icarus job, and there's more than one mystery that Rourke and Celine must work their way through in order to resolve them. The Path are particularly interesting to me. Did you create them based on any particular human society or culture?
No, they're just mostly the antagonists. If there is any parallel, it would be with the Soviet Union during the Cold War, except that instead of the military competition, it's all economic, with the Talariac drive that gives the Path a huge advantage over everybody else. So
hence their reason for wanting to control the transport.
Right. Yeah. Controlling transport, and edging out everybody else. We see this to some extent, maybe a little bit, with Chinese goods edging out everybody else, because very cheap labor, sometimes no cost at all, if you read the stories about what they do back there. Yeah. But the economics are always going to be very important in any kind of culture, any kind of competition between countries or peoples in general, and the Path fit that one. There's no military thing, but economics can be just as strong, as we learn when we ignore them.
Yes, and it seems like there's having not been read through on all the books before, it does seem like there's a bit of a stateless nature to some of the places that you go to, or at least that it's, because it's bounty hunters rather than police officers, badge men who might be police officers but might also just be or not necessarily servants to the whole state but to the planetary government, that kind of thing. So I was interested to find all that
We've got the badge men, the police as well, but we also have bounty hunters, because they're criminals who sneak through the cracks, and the police just don't have the resources to track down all of them. And there will be a certain interest that wants a particular criminal brought back, brought to justice, just brought to an accounting or whatever. So I don't see them as necessarily competing. They're working different sides of the street.
Right. So did you ever dip your toe into role-playing games at all?
I'm sorry?
Did you ever dip your toes into role-playing games at all?
Way back when, did a little bit of Dungeons and Dragons, till our group started getting married and having children and no time. Right. Generally, I've not done that much with it. I've done a little bit, but they are horrible time sucks. And I just don't have the time to do that. My idea of a game while I'm working out the next paragraph is a quick, fast game of Spider Solitaire or something. Right. Something that doesn't take a lot of brain power. I realized our son does a lot of games, strategy, tactic games, and I enjoy some of them. The problem is that's what I do for a living.
Right.
I do tactics and strategy, and the game is not an escape from that. It's just same thing I do every day. So I tend to like the simpler games, or maybe a word game like Scrabble or something. But I understand the appeal of role-playing games. I do enjoy when I get a chance. It's just I generally don't have a big block of time to
dedicate to
commit, dedicate to that. Yeah.
Right. So I only ask because a lot of it reminded me of Traveler, which is a lot of your world building in the Icarus job. And it reminded me of Mark Miller's Traveler game. So I was just wondering if that was had informed it at all.
Well, our son plays Traveler, so some of it may have gotten through by osmosis. You never know.
Of course. So penultimate question today. What, aside from its considerable raw entertainment value, do you hope readers will carry with them long after reading The Icarus Job?
Just in general, I think the big advantage of science fiction, and people talk about, well, it predicted the future if you cherry pick certain things. I think the big thing about science fiction, it teaches you to consequence test. Here is this invention. Here is the societal change. How can that affect things down line for good and for bad? And I think that is a skill that way too few people know. And people in government and industry really ought to know how to do that. And I don't think they do. You see a lot of bills passed. You see a lot of corporate decisions being made. And some of us look at that and say, that's not going to go well because someone is going to take advantage of this loophole or that loophole. I think science fiction teaches you to think that way,
right,
or help you learn to think that way. So, the Icarus saga is supposed to be entertainment, but thinking along the lines of what can happen, what can be done, how do you interact with other people to get them to do what you want or get them to do. One of my big bugaboos in TV and movie writing is when the character asks somebody hard bitten position of authority to do the right thing. No, you don't ask them to do the right thing. You show them how doing this will gain them.
Right.
Which is the whole thing between Rourke and subdirector Nask. Let me show you how doing what I need, what I want done will help you and your people.
Right.
And that is also a skill that I think too few people have. So, and take a page from Rourke, take a page from his father, learn some good sayings, and just have fun and learn a little bit about personal relationships and logical thinking while you're at it. But mostly have fun.
Right. Absolutely. That's a great answer. That's one of the best answers I've had while doing this. Consequence testing is hugely important and is not done enough in any field, but certainly not in politics.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Let's scrap everything and do the new thing, even though it's not really new. Yeah. And throw the baby out with the bathwater seems to be something that goes on far too often.
Yeah.
So last question, what conventions can your fans hope to catch you up with you at? And what other work do you have in the pipeline for fans to read?
Well, next weekend, I am in Indianapolis for Indiana Comic Con, I think. The full list that I can reveal right now is on my Facebook page, facebook.com/TimothyZahn. There is a featured post that has a list and links, and I'll be adding to that as other conventions announce me. Further books, as I said, I'm finishing up Icarus Coda, the last book in this series, unless the fans want more, in which case I'm sure I can find more stories to tell.
So the Icarus Coda is three more past this one, right?
Yes, there will be six plus the original Icarus Hunt.
Right.
So 7-book series or 6 books in a prequel, depending on how you want to think about it.
Right.
As soon as David Weber gets free of all the 250 books he is contracted to write, we'll be getting back to the Matagor Ascendant book 5. I've got a couple other projects going on. I'll be announcing as we get going. Doing a comic adaptation with Marvel for the Thrawn Alliances book from many years ago. First 2 issues are out. 3rd one comes out next week, I think. A couple of other surprises down the line. I'll be announcing everything on Facebook as appropriate. But yeah, I'll be around several conventions. I've got several projects in pipeline. and I'm keeping busy.
Are we seeing you at Dragon Con this year?
Yes, I'll be a dragon.
See you there. All right.
Okay,
well, thank you
sounds
again
good.
Very much. Thank you again, Tim, for joining us and overcoming the technical difficulties today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
This has been Timothy Zahn and Griffin Barber in conversation on the Icarus Job, forthcoming from Bain Books.
And now we bring you our audiobook serialization of Tinker by Wynn Spencer. Inventor girl genius Tinker lives in a near future Pittsburgh, which now exists mostly in the land of the elves. She runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. When a pack of wargs chase an elven noble into her scrapyard, life as she knows it takes a serious detour. Tinker finds herself taking on the Elven Court, the NSA, the Elven Interdimensional Agency, technology smugglers, and a college-minded xenobiologist as she tries to stay focused on what's really important, her first date. Armed with an intelligence the size of a planet, steel-toed boots, and a junkyard dog attitude, Tinker is ready to kick butt to get her first kiss.
Tinker felt guilty when she walked into the foyer and realized that Pony had been standing there since they returned from Toulouse. "Why don't you sit down?"
"It's not proper."
"Oh, sit down." She pointed at the chair beside the door. Pony sat, unhappy but obedient. Tinker settled on the fourth step of the staircase, which put her level with Pony. "What do you know about Oni?"
"Oni?"
Pony lifted his hands to his head and made his index fingers into horns. "Yes, Oni."
"They are cruel and ruthless people with no sense of honor. Their weapons are crude, for they are a younger race than either elves or humans. But they spawn like mice and would crush us with sheer numbers."
So much for Oni being mythical. "They live on Elfholm?" Pony looked puzzled at this.
"No, then they would have been elves. They live on Onihida."
"So where is Onihida?" Pony screwed up his face in the way that Tinker recognized as him reaching the limit of his ability to explain something. Finally, he held out his left hand, palm down.
"Elfholm."
He waved his right hand under it.
"Earth."
Then holding his right hand still, he moved his left hand under his right and waved it.
"Onihida."
She pointed at his left hand. "How did you get to Onihida? Or did the Oni come to Elfholm?"
"We found them."
Pony looked daunted. He sat silent for several minutes, thinking.
"There were, at one time, certain caves and rock formations that formed pathways to walk from one world to the next. They were perilous, for the movement of the moon and the planets made them inconstant."
It confirmed her family legend of caves being gates. Tinker suspected that a mineral deposit running through quartz next to a strong ley line could mimic the hyperphase field of a man-made gate. Like the gate in space, the power needed to be supplied to only one side to create two-way travel. Based on what Windwolf told her about gravity affecting magic, then perhaps ley lines had tides, which would cause the gates to occasionally fail.
Pony plunged on. "While we bent our minds to shaping magic, humans learned to forge bronze and then steel. For goods we could not make ourselves, we walked the pathways to Earth. We kept close to the pathways and traveled heavily cloaked and mostly at night, for without magic we lived a breath away from death. But the risks were always well rewarded with rich trade goods."
Obviously, Pony was using the historic we, since the pathways had mysteriously failed prior to the 1700s, and he had just hit his maturity. "But some of these pathways led to Onihida," Tinker guessed.
"In a manner, yes."
Pony scratched at the back of his head, pondering how to, as Tulu put it, compress history into a teaspoon.
"Where a pathway opened on Earth, magic would flow out.
While humans would only find a pathway through blind luck, a Demana could sense it from a distance.
Still, maps were made to keep careful track of the pathways. One day on Earth, a Demana found a pathway that was not on our maps. Nor, when the matching location was investigated on Elfholm, could it be found where it opened. A group adventurous in spirit decided to investigate where the pathway led. 20 journeyed out. Only 2 returned.
The Oni killed them?
Pony nodded. At first, the explorers had thought they'd somehow traveled to Elfholm, for Onihida, unlike Earth, flows rich with magic. Then they realized that the plants and the animals were unknown to them and showed signs of being spell-worked.
The elfin way of saying the object had been bioengineered.
Whereas on Earth, they would have easily traveled undetected. Wards revealed their presence, and they were surrounded before they could flee back to Earth. The Oni lords invited them to a nearby fortress. The explorers were treated well, served rich foods, and offered beautiful whores. The Oni called them their brothers and tried to deceive them. But a dragon always shows his teeth when he smiles.
The Oni wanted to know where the gate to Earth was?
Natural gates apparently were usually quite small.
Pony measured out 4 feet with his hand,
many only wide enough to take a pack horse through, and sometimes much smaller.
He reduced the width to only 2 feet.
They were within dark caves, and like the veil effect,
he waved his hand about to take in the house around him, shoved from Earth into Elfholm.
Invisible. Anyone without the ability to detect a ley line could search closely, even to the point of stepping in and out of worlds and never find it. Like the elves prior to the birth of Damana, no Oni passing through a gate to Earth had ever returned.
So that the Oni didn't realize a gate wasn't just a death trap to be avoided until the elves showed up. Obviously, the explorers didn't reveal its location.
At first, they easily evaded the questions, for they did not know the Oni language, and deliberately misunderstood their gestures and the demands for maps to be drawn. But they were forcibly detained, taught the tongue, and asked more directly. Then they were tortured, then healed and tortured again until their minds broke.
That's horrible, Tinker shuddered. But the gate only led to Earth. The elves could have given it up to the Oni without risking Elfholm.
Pony stood to pace. The Oni had spellworked their warriors to be far stronger than the average man. What's more, they had discovered the secrets of self-healing and immortality, yet continued to breed like mice. With their numbers and abilities, they would have flooded Earth unchecked.
I'm surprised that the elves cared that much about Earth.
The explorers had traveled Earth for centuries. Some had taken human lovers and sired half-breed children.
He leaned against the banister to give her a soulful look. She found herself suddenly aware of his eyes, dark and full of sincere concern.
We have always seen humans as our reflection, good and bad. Man was how gods made the elves before the Skin Clan remade them.
Pony spoke with the same bitterness as Tulu used while explaining the origin of the Damana as the ruling caste. If elves hate the Skin Clan so much, why hasn't spellworking been banned?
It was for a while. Blight struck our main grain crop, though, and a great famine followed. So one of our most holy ones, Tempered Steel, petitioned for reform. Evil lies in the heart of elves, not in magic.
This was one bit of elfin history she knew, learned from puppet shows during the harvest fair. Only she had never understood the full context. Much was made that Tempered Steel was a Sakasha monk, which made sense now, since Adamana's motives for bringing back spellworking would have been questionable. The creation of Keva beans was linked to Tempered Steel's reform, saving the elves from starvation.
2 of the explorers survived?
She steered the conversation back to the Oni. 2 escaped, reached the gate, and returned to Elfholm. Once their tale was told, Sakasha were sent to destroy the gate from Onihida to Earth. And then systematically all gates from Earth to Elfholm were destroyed.
That seems rather drastic. Pony clicked his tongue.
They say an elfin carpenter is more thorough than a human one, for he has forever to hammer down nails.
Did they warn travelers first?
We had no way of contacting all the far-flung traitors.
Thus, her elfin ancestor and Tulu were trapped on Earth. While long-lived, without a source of magic, even elves age and die. Pony half-turned, head cocked,
Someone is coming. There were footsteps on the porch, and the front door opened. Oil Can paused in the doorway, surprised to find Tinker and Pony in the foyer, focused on his arrival. He tried for nonchalant, but Tinker could read the tension in him.
Hey.
Hey. Tinker held out her hand to him. I got back early, too. He lifted his arm to take her hand and allowed her to pull him wearily into the room.
Is it good?
He meant the news about the tests. It's good. Tinker gave his hand a squeeze before letting go. Everything's cool. The tension flooded out of him with a huge sigh, and he grinned hugely at her.
Ah, oh, that's great.
Lane's making lunch. And she's finished, Lane called from the kitchen. Come eat while it's hot.
That was another installment in Wynn Spencer's Tinker, and that's it for the podcast. Thanks as always to Audible.com and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And good night, Tony Daniel, wherever you are. This is David F. Shirod coming to you from a soundproof bunker somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. Join us here next week in the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.